Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Alexis McLeod, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Asian American Studies at the University of Connecticut. I'm co-host of this channel along with Robert Talese, Carrie Figdor, and Sarah Tyson. I'm joined today by Shay Welsh, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Spelman College. She's here to discuss her new book, The Phenomenology of a Performative Knowledge System, Dancing with Native American Epistemology. So thanks for joining me today to talk about your book. Also, congratulations on the book. It's a really great book. I really enjoyed it a lot. I think it's doing really important work that not enough philosophers are doing. So thank you.
Thanks.
So first, I wanted to ask you how you got into philosophy in general and how you came to the topic of this book in particular.
Yikes. I don't know. I got to philosophy like in one of those mystical divine right sort of things insofar as like I took an intro to ethics class, I don't know, maybe when I was a sophomore, and I failed it. And I blame this 90% on the teacher, though. To this day, I still look back and think, God damn, man, what were you doing? But I swore that I would never take philosophy again. And it was the dumbest thing on earth. And you know, why did I have to take this class for a requirement? And then like my graduating semester, I still had one humanities requirement to take. And the only one that was available was another intro to ethics class that was taught by a different guy. Much better teacher, much less personality. And I don't know if it was that he actually was teaching it, or that I just was ready. I don't know, but it was just like within a week, it just absolutely changed my life. I just couldn't imagine there being anything better in the world than that. And I was graduating, and I remember saying to somebody, like, oh, I wish people could still grow up and be philosophers. Wouldn't that be neat? Because I didn't know there were still like actual philosophers in the world. And he was like, oh, you can be a philosopher. You just have to go to graduate school. And I was like, what's graduate school? And I mean, to be fair, like I'm first generation, and I was just fumbling through college and, you know, just minimally surviving. Right. And so I kind of looked it up and I was like, holy shit, I can be a philosopher. That sounds fancy. And, so I stuck around an extra year and I did like the whole major in a year. And actually I got a 4.0 the whole year. That was like the first time I'd ever made A's ever in college. And I was like, whoa, I was like, this is for me. And, so I decided to take a year off and go party in Tokyo just to give myself a break and get some life, you know, some experiences. Right. And, while I was there, I studied for the GRE and, read a bunch of philosophy on my own. Like I went to the bookstore and got some Japanese philosophy books and stuff. And I applied to grad school from there. And I got in on some affirmative action shit because I swear a lot.
That's okay.
Because the school that I went to was just like no women. Like, none at all. And the only way that I knew how to apply to graduate school was, like, by where the weather was good. So I went to the entirely wrong graduate program on the first attempt. But I got in, and that's all that mattered. And then, I mean, that was just it. That was, I mean, for me, I've always felt like it was my calling. I felt like it is the meaning in my life. So I'm pretty emotionally attached to my projects. And so when people say something like, oh, your book is really good and I really like it and it really does something for me, or it really helps me think about things in different ways, I feel like, you know, that's the reason why I'm alive, which might seem like a little over the top, but you know, when we're all looking for a reason to be here, like, That kind of helps me make sense of it all.
No, I mean, that sounds good. I mean, you can tell it. It seems to me from the book too. You can tell your kind of passion, and you can see that in the writing and the way it comes out in this book, in particular.
Well, that's good. Yeah.
So you started on a different topic, right? And when you started in philosophy.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, the first thing that I did when I started graduate school is I asked them if there was native philosophy and if I could do that. And they told me there was no such thing.
I've heard that one before.
Yeah. And I ended up in a program that was all philosophy of science and action theory, none of which I do. And there was only one woman professor there, and she happens to be a feminist political philosopher. And I did, I ended up changing graduate programs, obviously, because I was not in the right place. But like, while I knocked out my master's there, I did all of my work, like independent study with her outside of my core classes, and trained hardcore in feminist political philosophy. And so like, when I went up to Binghamton to do and finish up my PhD, that's how I stayed into feminist political philosophy and feminist ethics, because that was like the specialty of the program.
Right.
So I started there, and I just kind of, if you ever look at my work, it's all very drastically different, and it all is just where I'm at in my life at that moment. I don't feel compelled to stick to a canon. I don't feel compelled to stick to like a specialization. If I find something that I feel like there's something to be said, then I go for it, and I end up having to teach myself like entirely new discipline, like sub disciplines. And it takes me a really long time. But I'd rather be doing that than kind of like rehashing the same sort of subject matter, like to the point where I hate what I do.
Right.
Yes. So I started, I mean, and I'm still like in the, you know, I still consider myself, like a feminist philosopher. You know, I do feminist political, feminist ethics, feminist epistemology. I do all of that stuff. After this project that I'm working on now, I'm trying to think about ways that I can bring what I'm doing now to feminist ethics and maybe feminist moral psychology. I'm not sure how to do it yet. So I just go where my little heart leads me, and I just kind of try to enjoy the ride, as frustrating as it can be.
That's in my view, that's the best way to do it. That's kind of similar to what I do as well, kind of all over the place.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I noticed. I was like, whoa, we got everything. Okay. My bad.
That's fun. You get bored with one project all the time, you say, right?
Yeah.
So in this book, one of the things that I thought was really cool and something that you don't see a lot of is a focus on movement and dance in particular. In connection with meaning that you talk about, that's really at the core of the book. And I wanted to see if you could say a little bit something about how that works in the project.
So can you be a little more specific about what you mean by the connection between dance and meaning? Because that is huge.
So the idea of expression of meaning through dance, right? Is that kind of the idea at the core? Like, I mean, in which way that meaning is expressed through dance, or that it might be a way of expressing particular kinds of meaning, like it's something like language or broader than language or different?
I mean, yeah. So in that book, I talk about it as expressing meaning. And then in the project that I'm working on now, I'm talking about it generating methods of inquiry. So for me, and I guess you can think of dance very broadly.
Right.
And also meaning very broadly. I think that embodiment, I feel like, and it has been my experience, and obviously I write from a very specific subjective position. It's my experience that all of my meaning all of the time comes from my body. Mm. And how I understand the world and how the world comes back to connect to me, like with purpose, and the ways that I go around digging in my consciousness or whatever for ideas. I'm constantly engaging in some kind of movement. I think I somewhere use the example of like, if I'm struggling while I'm writing and there's like an intuitive idea, like I start sort of like dancing around like in my office or in my chair and I'm like, what is it? What is it? And you know, I just kind of like sing and dance and I'm like, shake it out. Where's the idea? What is it? And like out of nowhere, like boom, I shake out this idea and I'm like, there it is. It was in my body and I just needed to move it up to my brain, which, you know, not to get some dualist perspective, but you know what I mean? So it was like implicit and I had to move around and make it explicit. That's just a quirky, cute little example that, right. You know, right. Meaning makes no sense without movement in anything. Like I can't imagine having any kind of meaningful experience or behaving in meaningful sorts of ways without movement being involved. And I think that dance is a sort of purposeful, like very poetic but analytic way of engaging in meaning through your body that happens all the time by itself anyways. Mm. If that makes sense.
Right. So there, I mean, one thing I was wondering in Native American traditions in general, is there something particular expressed that goes kind of beyond what's expressible in spoken or written language in dance, or is there something different going on?
Well, I guess there are two ways to look at it. I mean, one is that I guess it's kind of universally true that the body, like as I repeat over, like the body knows things that we don't have words for.
Right, right.
And for me, like my big thing is always like the intersections of affects and intersections of emotions that are real, but that we don't have language for. And so I don't think, and this goes for gesture too, like, I don't think it's a different language. I don't think it's an extension of language. I just think it's language. I just think it's nonverbal language. I don't think it's pre-verbal language, because a lot of people will try to get into that whole like more primitive notion of expression and dance. But I just mean like it's such a clear means of communication. I think if you were going to look at it from like a Native American perspective and possibly true for most other indigenous oral traditions, it would be true that dancing says things because it's alive, it's in movement, it's in motion. And the idea of the written word as dead and static in itself, right, already puts a limitation on things that verbal language can do if it's been written down. But like narrative, a lot of times, I mean, it's not like when people engage in narrative oral storytelling that they're static. I mean, it is a very involved practice as well that involves embodiment and movement, maybe not always dancing, but something of the sort. So I think once I tend to agree, like once something is written down, it's dead at that point, because the idea has been captured and tamed and now you're just passing it out like,
right.
You know, like you're passing it around like a picture.
Right, right. Yeah, they're in the Maya Popol Vuh, there's something that's interesting near the end. They talk about the reason they needed to write it down because the Popol Vuh could no longer be seen, with the idea being that it was originally supposed to be performed, not kind of read as a text. And that the reason they put it in this text is because like the Spanish were suppressing this. Right? And so, right. which is interesting, because it seems like what's being expressed there and what's being expressed in movement and in dance is something that you really can't say. Is that kind of an idea that arises in the traditions that you're talking about?
It's not something that I have personally found discussed extensively. I mean, all of the stuff that I've read from the Native and Indigenous dancers talk about the way that your body goes inside to find, you know, knowledge and knowing from the inscape and bringing it forward and being able to communicate that through the body.
Right, right.
But in terms of, like, dancing being something specific in the way that you're talking about, I think that it's implicit in all the stuff that I've read. I haven't seen anybody like hash out like a hard analytic argument that that's true, but I assume that it follows.
Right, right. So one thing I wanted to ask about is that you talk about one of the interesting things that you say early on in the book. You talk about this distinction between knowing as active and dynamic in Native epistemology versus knowledge as dependent on what you call thingifying human experience, which is the latter, which strikes me as very similar to what you see in the early Chinese text Zhuangzi. What are the key differences between these two kinds of knowing?
So the short version of it is just that Western and Eurocentric frameworks of knowledge and knowing and truth are about our ability to objectify the world so that we can take ownership and possession of things of the world, and that we can partake with them as if they're commodities and, you know, exchanges. Right. Whereas an active form of knowing is all about what you're doing with what and how you know, and that it's not something to be owned. It's not a way of going out into the world and exerting control over the world and over others, but it's a way of participating in the world. Right. So I think it's just the way of looking at your role in the world. You know, like, one is a perspective of domination and the other one is participation. And if you conceive of it, like, if your intent is to control and dominate and objectify and possess, then you're always going to conceive of knowledge as a thing that you lock down and that you can take for yourself and then you can sell off somewhere else later. But if you think of knowing as dynamic, then that's always going to be about leading you to ways of leading and living your life and how to engage in practices, either interpersonally or with the world, that creates more meaningful relationships with your existence in it.
Right. Knowledge as a kind of action, dynamic. That's interesting. And you talk about this kind of connected to, because in the analysis of knowledge, you talk about this connected to truth as well, which ends up being a kind of dynamic and active notion of truth that you call truthing, which I thought was fascinating. And you connect this to what you call the procedural analysis of truth. I wonder, could you say a bit more about how truth is dynamic in this way?
Yeah. So first off, the term truthing was also coined in some of the indigenous science works that I had. So I just want to point out that I didn't coin it, but whenever I read it, I was like, of course, truth.
Right.
That's exactly the word I'm looking for.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, the thing is whenever I started reading Native epistemology and learning more about it, it just seems so obviously true. And the idea of truth being this sort of proposition, this static proposition, seems so banal and uninteresting and uninformative about what truth is really supposed to give to our lives. And I think I talk in the book, I try to articulate, like, there are accurate things, and statements can be accurate or inaccurate, right?
Right.
But the way in which you use this information to engage as a person with others and in the world is what makes truthing. So long as you satisfy those requirements for truth in Native epistemology, which is, you know, the respectful, successful performance of some action for some goal. And for me, truth is a normative concept, because what it's telling us something very important about our perspectives.
Right.
And when I think of like bland, like old school epistemology, analytic epistemology, I just think like these conversations really have no purpose. Like they're doing nothing in the world. But when you think about truth as being a function of action, and that you can determine truth by your ability to truth, right? By how well and you go about your actions with the things that you know to be accurate or not, that says a lot about who we are, and that says a lot about who we should be and how we're engaging what we've come across. 'Cause like in the work that I cite from John Dufour, he talks about these social practices of knowing. And for me, that is the relevance of truth to our lives philosophically, is that truth is really uninteresting when I'm sitting here alone in my office, like knocking out chapters in books, like, oh, I know this to be true. Like, who fucking cares? But it's like, if I find out something to be the case, and then I go out into the world and I start acting on this information that I happen to think is accurate, how am I using it? That says something really important. It's beyond just claiming to have knowledge. It's claiming to be in relationship with the truth, through ethical ways of knowing and acting.
Right.
Yeah.
This is interesting. There's actually some kind of close similarities with some of the things that you see in some of the things I work on in the Chinese tradition in the Han Dynasty, where human concerns come into the picture when you're talking about truth, right? So right. as you mentioned, being normative, right? That part of what we're thinking about when we're thinking about whether something is true is whether there's a property that we're actually seeking and that we actually care about and that we can actually kind of like do something with, right?
Right.
this strikes me as very similar to what's going on in Native American tradition.
And the thing is like, I think one of the reasons why, you know, I'm always trying to put forth the idea that this isn't distinctive to Native or Indigenous peoples. This is just the perspective of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's like the right view, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is another way of looking at our existence in the world.
Mm.
And so there's a lot, and it's becoming the case that it's becoming a hot topic in environmental ethics and just in some small areas of scientific methodologies about incorporating this Native or Indigenous perspective on ethical practices of truth related to truth, because the way that we engage in science should be enhanced or constrained by these normative practices of being truthful. And I think that it's just, you know, and somebody once mentioned, like, I can't believe that your publisher let you get away with that title, because it's a monstrosity and it's convoluted. And to be fair, that wasn't the title that I picked. I really was just going to title it Dancing with Native American Epistemology.
They always make you change it for some reason.
Yeah, but the idea from the publisher was that they wanted it to appeal to a broader base, which is
right,
true.
Right.
I want it to appeal to a broader base. And so I try to flesh out these ideas to the best of my ability to show the relevance of this perspective to everyone. Right. I mean, it would be great if scientists and doctors and political philosophers were taking these perspectives into account when they were talking about what they thought was true.
Right.
And I think that if they did, then the world would look like a lot. It would look like a much better place.
Hmm. That's interesting. I mean, so how do you, because this is something that comes up in my own work, too. How do you balance this idea that, okay, are you talking about a tradition and what a tradition says versus talking about what the correct view is, something like that. I mean, because oftentimes I find myself saying things like, well, I'm interested in what the ancient Maya thought or what the early Chinese thought, but I also think this is plausible and we should actually, we should take this seriously, right? But there's sometimes it's presented this tension between the two where people kind of conflate the two or think you're doing one and you're not doing the other. How do you balance those two? Do you generally kind of have a problem with that kind of thing?
I don't think so. I mean, not for myself. I think that one of the ways in which Native and Indigenous philosophy has been excluded up until this point was for other people to convince themselves that these ideas are constrained to the tradition and that it's not for them.
Right. It's simply only in this group, right?
Yeah, it's simply only in this group. And it sure is a good thing that all those people have died off because now I don't have to learn it.
Right.
So, and for me, it's just obvious, you know, that certain ideas are beneficial to living a good life.
Hmm.
And I feel like when people try to say, when they try to cordon off something like Native or Indigenous philosophy, they're doing it to their own better, like, to reinsure their own privilege, that they don't have to take these ideas seriously because it doesn't belong to them. But it's just, these are just perspectives on the world and they're good ones. And so maybe it would be a good idea if you thought about it for a minute.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the things I find really plausible that comes up in Mesoamerican philosophy and that you talked about here too, is this idea of what you call blood memory, right? Like kind of like connection to the past, connection to ancestors, things like this. And the idea that spirit as well as aspects of body are kind of passed down to descendants. How does this work in the traditions that you're talking about here? Is it a spirit that's shared between generations, or does one generation influence the other and it works in that way, or is there like a multitude of different ways that this works?
Also not something that I've read a full-on scientific study on. Also something that is huge in Black feminist theory, right? So blood memory, while the phrasing I think is distinctive to Native peoples, it's a phenomenon that is much wider and more broadly experienced than people first think when they hear the term blood memory. I think there are a couple of ways you can think about how blood memory works. One of them would be the notion that the spirit of the universe, which, you know, in my book, you know, I point out in different nations have different names. The one that I use the most is the one that Viola Cordova uses, which is Usin, right? So that pervades all things, and that is, you know, forever. So we've all got a bit of Usin in us, and that Usin keeps going through us. The other is that there's a greater knowledge in the universe that is cut off from us, or it's not necessarily cut off from us. It's cut off from most people, but not, I think maybe a Western term would be like not the devout. I think that you can, through ceremony, you can access some of this knowledge. It's just, you know, sacred knowledge, but that is also shared within each person. And then you have the spirit of the ancestors that go with people, right? Forever. It's an accumulation of your ancestors, of everyone who's gone before you. And it's that notion of the ancestors that I think that it's the most commonly used. And I think, like, if you were going to put like some, if you felt compelled to look at the science, right, that would be like the genetic inheritance of things like trauma, right? This idea of blood memory, you know, is experienced by, you know, Jews who are descended from folks in the Holocaust. I mean, it's descended from colonized peoples and, you know, like children of slaves. And, you know, because I work at an HBCU, so this is a notion that when I bring this up in Native philosophy, while everything else is very foreign to them, this notion of blood memory and having the memory of the ancestors come with you over time is not.
It's not an
absurd notion. They're like, oh yes, of course, yes,
absolutely.
This, you know,
so, and that's one of the things that that's one of the things I found most plausible about the tradition when I first encountered it for that same reason.
It does make sense because the connections just don't sever. I don't think, and I think that we bring with us, you know, the difficulties, and I think I have a lot of personal experience with this, given like generational trauma in my own family. So that I oftentimes feel the need to report back to them in my behavior. Or I feel the influence of them in the choices that I make. And I feel, you know, the influence of people like my aunts and my grandfather and stuff like that in different situations. But, you know, it's one of those things that from a Western perspective is just going to be like, oh, that's some voodoo shit. but I think the way that we are a product of our kinships and our relationships and our connections, like it just makes sense that we take those pieces with us.
Right. It's interesting. Do you see this as tying into, because it sounds like there's an issue of personal identity involved as well, right? So that like in a sense that kind of, well, if you think about what we are as individuals, as persons, part of that at least is what our ancestors are. I mean, we're not like kind of distinct, kind of completely autonomous individuals in that sense. Is that something you find in the tradition?
I think that people would largely agree to that claim. Yeah, I mean, just like ontologically speaking, we are not severed from the connections that come before us. So, because we are always in relation, whether to who is in front of us, or who came before us. I mean, you can, and I would wonder if this is something that maybe some adopted people experience having difficulties with, which is why they sometimes look for their biological families. I know that a friend of mine finally reached out to her biological family, and things just started like so she achieved a lot of clarity in her life and about herself by reestablishing those relationships. And I feel like maybe if there's some similarity there with like who your kin are here, I mean, it would just seem to follow that it mattered who your kin was not so long ago.
Right.
I mean, I could be entirely wrong.
It seems like it's an idea, the notion of kind of discovering who you are, right, is a matter of, and it's similar to, you know, how people like look at things like, you know, these DNA tests and things like that to find kind of previous ancestors, the idea being like, I'm kind of discovering something about myself, right? This being the idea.
Yeah, and one of the things that I have to be really careful with is trying to be careful about the biological notion, because it doesn't hold, right? So
right.
I'm sure that you're... It's not in Mesoamerican philosophy, I'm sure it holds the same, that it's not a biological conception, but it's not wholly not biological.
Right.
It's kind of hard, like, I mean, because it's spiritual.
Right.
I would term it naturalistic. But I don't think that I would jump the bridge and, you know, and say that, it's biological essentialism or anything of the sort.
Right.
Because it is when Native folks talk about, and you know, just to repeat, as I said in the book, like I have no authentic upbringing. My reason for doing Native philosophy is to try to bring something positive to my family's difficult relationship with their identity. So like I don't have anything I can't contribute because I wasn't raised in these traditions. But I don't, you can rediscover, you know what I mean? You can reconnect, you can rediscover, you can do these kinds of things, but the what causes the problem is not the break of the biological line, but like the break of the relationship to land and the break in the relationship to kin. And that's not something that that has to be biological.
Right.
If I understand that right, you know what I'm saying? It's about kinship and about place. Mm. So, and while, you know, we do talk about like inherited generational trauma and the way that DNA can be affected and passed down, there is that biological aspect of it. But I think if we were to say that that's what it is and that's only what it is, then we would be taking away a lot of what it is meant to be, which is about relationship.
So I've heard a lot of philosophers recently, and I've read a lot of work recently where people are talking about knowledge. So you talk about a lot about knowledge in this book, and they're talking about the kind of traditional Western notion of propositional knowledge as failing to properly capture like a wide variety of forms of knowing. I mean, what you say in the book, it seems like it's really consistent with this, right? A kind of alternative conceptions of knowing. And do you see the Native American conceptions of knowing that you talk about here as potentially independent conceptions of knowing that could operate on their own, or rather something like forming part of a pluralistic or a syncretistic conception of knowledge that has something like propositional knowledge plus these other ways of knowing?
Right. Yeah. So I think, what is supposed to be very specific to the analytic analysis is that it's the notion of truth that is distinct and that, you know, because it's a function of action, but that we can talk about knowledge and knowing in pluralistic ways.
Right.
So, and I think that it's also just part of like the Native perspective to refuse to insist that there's only one way of ever doing anything. I think if I were to be like, oh no, there is no propositional knowledge. I mean, there certainly is propositional knowledge. The way that I try to make it clear in the book is to say, sure, there's propositional knowledge and there's procedural knowledge. It's that truth is procedural and not propositional.
Right.
Right.
I wonder if this idea that there's like the one true way or the one true knowledge has to do with this kind of idea of ownership that you were talking about before.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. there's got to be the one right way, and whoever convinces or forces enough other people to believe it wins.
right.
So it doesn't matter if it's accurate or if it's the best way or if it improves like human existence or like makes life better for the animals. Like, is as long as it's the most popular, then that's the score.
Right. Well, there's one thing in the book that I thought that you did that I thought was really cool. And there's in the appendix, you have a 1921 letter from the head of the Canadian Department of Indian Affairs that argues for the suppression of the practice of dancing in Native communities. And I thought, I saw this fascinating because this is something you find often, right? So there's a suppression of things like the sun dance or the kind of ghost dance movement. And like it's like this problem with dance in particular as something that's problematic for a number of different reasons, right? So here in the letter that you talk about, it talks about how people are idle and they're not working and things like this because they're dancing. But then in other kind of contexts, it's, oh, it's dangerous or it stirs people up. Why do you think there's this, like, in particular, this kind of, this strong response to dance in particular?
I mean, there has been for colonized people all over time in the world, right? I mean, the slaves were
right.
not supposed to dance. I mean, I've seen Footloose. It's been a while, but they weren't supposed to dance either. I think the idea is that dance is very powerful. I mean, you don't need anything else for that kind of art and expression. It's a way of both. It's a way of simultaneously tapping in to tap out, you know, that is, it's powerful, it's spiritual, it's, dance can change people's moods, it can change people's minds, it can, you know, it can change an environment, I've just, I mean, I've seen a number of movies where many of battles have been ceased by the introduction of a dance. But I think that's just what it is. It's that people gain so much through the activity of dancing that, I mean, it automatically leads a person towards a sense of freedom. Right? It leads somebody towards a connection to spirituality. It leads somebody to the higher ends of, I don't know, consciousness. That's a janky word. That's not exactly the word that I'm looking for right now, but it brings us to a higher state. And that higher state is always a productive state, like emotionally or intellectually or politically. It's also a bonding experience, right? It can establish like relations of solidarity. So I imagine, I mean, if your goal as a colonizer or as an enslaver is to keep people acting right and to not be worked up, right, then you're going to make sure that they're not dancing, if nothing else.
Right, right. That's interesting. And there's kind of a self-directedness in some sense to that as well, right? In certain aspects of the self of the Western tradition, is like, this is something we're not supposed to do, right? And I mean, it seems like a kind of like implicit recognition of its power or its meaning, right? But then it's like beneath the surface, right? Nobody kind of tackles it explicitly, right?
Right. And there are, while there's not much in mainstream philosophy on dance, even since I'm still working on dance right now, there are a couple of places where people talk about the Eurocentric devaluation of dancing, given either its association with the feminine, which you have to stamp out, right, or with its valorization or acknowledgement of the body,
right,
and the body itself being the source of all evil, you know what I mean? So if you know, colonizers were already coming in with this sort of loathing of the body, then encountering communities who engaged in knowledge production and knowledge sharing, in part through movement or through dancing, you know, and they engage in worship through dancing, that's going to be like a double jeopardy sort of situation where they're hitting two bad things at the same time. They're like, well, we've got the body and we've got like the assumption that the body can access God, you know, and we've got to get rid of both of those because they're both going to interfere with our ability to sustain like authority.
Right. Right. So one interesting thing in the final chapter, you talk about expression of truth through dancing, and in particular expression of truth through dancing and its connection to individual or communal experience and locality, which I thought was interesting, that notion of location. Could you say a little bit more about how that works in particular with location, the expression of truth in that way?
Well, Brian Burkhart's book on indigenizing philosophy through the land that I cite in my work does a significantly better job of talking about this than I ever can. But the general idea is that part of the meaning of our existence and part of our understanding of the world is a function of our connection to place and of being in locality. And right. And that includes like recognizing your own subjectivity and other subjectivity, not trying to be abstract or universal or objective or these kinds of things. And that you can generate more meaningful kinds of knowledge through dancing in the environment. So there are a couple of things that I've read about some Native and Indigenous dancers where, which is much like ceremony, they go outside and they take their shoes off and they dance with the environment, with the land, right? And that this brings them a kind of embodied knowledge that's tied to place, And it's definitely because relation to place is not something that we're ever taught about in the Western tradition of any discipline.
Definitely.
Right. It's hard to kind of talk about it without it seeming mysterious, but if you take your shoes off and you go outside and you dance, it makes more sense. I mean, I guess some people might think of it in terms of a wave as being in communion with the world and with where you come from, and establishing relationships of responsibility to the land, and those kinds of things. So there are various ways that you can think about the connection between dancing and locality, generally, and from a Native and Indigenous perspective. But as I don't think that I can do the best job when it comes to locality, because I don't have that tied to place, you know? And I think that there are people who do have a really close connection to where they and their people are from. And that, like, when I try to talk about it, really, it's more of me trying to intellectualize it. And I don't have a place inside me from which to speak about it. So I try to address these things by noting how important it is to Native and Indigenous frameworks. But sometimes it's like, I can do my best to try to explain it, but it's not always going to be the clearest expression because I don't completely understand it myself.
And I think it's really important because a lot of times, as you mentioned, in the Western tradition, we tend to neglect our locatedness. I mean, we're located as well, and we sometimes act as if we're not, right? You know, like growing up, I always heard this thing like, "Oh, I don't have an accent." Like, so you certainly have an accent, right? It's just you think of yourself as non-located, something like. And it seems like there's a tendency to do that in the tradition, philosophical tradition as well, right? And you kind of see that locatedness when you get outside of the tradition and see other things like Native American philosophy and these other traditions, which I think is really important here.
Yeah, and it would be, I mean, given that we're all just entrenched in Western, like, in Western metaphysics, period, if you have not been raised in a traditional way, you're constantly trying to fight with the constructs that you've been given your whole life, and what you're trying to do is see outside of it, and even when you give it your best, and even when you get it, you can't always articulate it. Mm. And I think that's why it's really important. And I'm very excited that there are so many like young scholars coming up who are being able to reconnect with their traditions. Mm. You know, they're doing a lot of important work and a lot of reclaiming of their culture and their language and their practices, and they're bringing it to the academy. And this is great because, you know, some of us are struggling really hard to try to make a foundation, especially, you know, when I think about Native philosophy, there have been so few people doing it. Mm. But now that we're being more visible and we're putting out more work, there are other people who are able to engage in these reclamation practices, and then they are going to be able to bring it to philosophy. And those are going to be the people who are, you know, really going to be able to tell you what it's like. I mean, you have sort of like the people who came before, you know, with Vida Laurie Jr., who was telling us all these wonderful things. Now you've got these young scholars coming in. And so it seemed like we were getting away from it, but now we're coming back to it. Like, and so, you know, I see a lot of shortcomings in my work because I don't have any cultural practices, and that's okay. You know, I have a very constrained set of things that I can do philosophically. And for me, that is just to try to flesh out certain kinds of analyses, more deeply. And then, you know, hopefully other people will be coming to this and then giving more substance to the ideas that are being set out.
I think, I mean, that could be really important to people like us, like what I work on Maya philosophy and don't have any ancestral connection there, but that it shows that people outside of these traditions could actually engage with and learn from, right, and use the kind of ideas in these traditions.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing is, like you said, sometimes I think, like, people use the excuse that they are not X for why they don't have to read it.
Right,
or engage it, or why, you know, nobody is Native at this school, so we should not have any readings on Native anything whatsoever. I feel like a lot of times, like, that's not helpful.
Right,
like, that's not helpful. I'm like, you read Marx, you know, outside right. of your own training, and now you can teach a little bit of Marx. Like, just, you know, come on, you can do it. And there are lots of people who are engaging with Native Indigenous philosophy who are not Native and Indigenous, and they do great work. And those are things, I mean, maybe there's a debate, but, you know, within reasonable constraints, that's exactly what they should be doing. And I pretty much try to think of the way that I do my own work as more under what qualifies as allyship work than indigenizing. So at Pacific APA, I'll be presenting a paper on, like, you know, should we be indigenizing philosophy? And when I talk about what indigenizing philosophy is, like, according to this analysis, I certainly don't indigenize philosophy. I don't bring anything to the table that needs to be brought to the table for philosophy to be indigenized. I do Native philosophy, and lots of people do Native philosophy, but you definitely have to have stronger cultural ties and intentions to be indigenizing philosophy. And, you know, and I think that if people take up traditions with, you know, respect and thoughtfulness, that, you know, they can do that work too. That's kind of why I push so much where Native philosophy can improve on Western philosophy, or where it solves problems that have existed in Western philosophy that, if you look at it from these perspectives, wouldn't be there, you know, is because I'm trying to create more space for Native Indigenous philosophy in the academy. And like I said, like, I don't write anything new, you know, just because my father and my grandfather are of a certain place, you know, doesn't give me any special, like, special knowledge about what happens for Native folks. You know, I have just as much knowledge as most other people. I just have more of a vested interest in learning about it. But I recognize that there are huge constraints about the way that I can phrase things, or the influence that I can say that I have on it. You know, like, like I said, I'm certainly not indigenizing philosophy. And I think that if people recognize that engaging other traditions of marginalized people, I mean, that doesn't make you a colonizer. That actually alleviates some of the problems of imperialism.
Right.
And I guess
cooperation rather than ownership, right?
Right. I mean, this is something that I think about a lot, and it's a complicated issue. But I certainly, you know, when the publisher was like, "Hey, you want your book to appeal to more people?" I was like, "Yes, in fact, I do." You know what I mean? I want people to be able to cite Native or Indigenous philosophy in a regular ass paper. You don't have to only cite Native or Indigenous work in Native and Indigenous papers.
Amen. Absolutely.
you can just be writing on Black anger and cite a Native philosophy paper. And that was a bad example, because Black feminists are certainly more likely to be using Native and Indigenous feminists than any other people. That was just the students writing a topic on it, and it came to mind. But you know what I mean? Like, you could just be writing about chairs and just so happen to read some native metaphysics and use it in your like bibliography. Mm-hmm. It's not like, right. Oh my God, if this paper isn't about native philosophy, I cannot. That would be so weird if I used a native philosopher. Like,
right, right.
I don't know.
Absolutely.
Sorry.
I'm curious. What are your plans to extend this project on Native American philosophy into other areas? And so you talk mostly about knowledge here, but are you working on any other areas and trying to tie this in concerning things in the Native American tradition?
I mean, it's certainly related, but it is not an extension of Native American philosophy. I mean, I guess you can. I guess it just depends, like how we were talking earlier about how you define Native philosophy. Mm. I mean, I don't imagine that it's going to be entirely separate. So it's just not going to be like the Native American philosophy.
Right.
So when I was writing the book, you know, all of the stuff that I was talking about was how dance is used as an expression in a way of expressing truth and establishing truth and those kinds of things. But the more I started thinking about choreographing and dancing and the kind of ideas that I was having that would help me explicate some of the more convoluted aspects made me realize that, practices of choreographing are also ways of creating questions about the world. Mm. So a lot of times a lot of dance theory and a lot of people will just say, sure, dancing can tell the truth, or dancing is narrative storytelling, or dancing does express, or all these kinds of things. But I started thinking about it in terms of like mining your body for questions, way to question the world. Mm. There were like different kinds of practices of thinking about ideas and trying to engage in movement practices or choreographing practices that help you think about the kinds of questions you have about an experience or the kinds of questions you have about a social context or something of the sort. And it's very difficult and it's all very intuitive. And I have been reading tons and tons of stuff, and it's there, but I can't get it out yet. And so I just keep reading. Like every so often, I'll find these things, and I'm like, yes, that is exactly what I need to be able to make this argument. And like the pieces that I'm finding to help me put together my idea is like every 3 months. Like, and I'm reading. You know, I'm on this track where I'm trying to read like 100 pages of philosophy a day, and that's painful. And it's just like, and I'm reading and I'm reading and I'm reading, and I'm like, this is fine, this is fine, this is fine. And then like 3 months go by and I'm like, ooh, that's useful. Mm. And then I just keep engaging in this process because what I'm looking for hasn't been said.
Right.
And so I'm just reading everything that I can read, like in the cognitive science and activism stuff, in somatic theory and dance therapy and like actual choreographing practices and Henry Bergson. Mm. Like for some reason I'm very convinced Henry Bergson is giving me what I need. I just cannot figure out what Henry Bergson is. I'm reading all these things and I'm like, yes, this is going to give me something that I need, and I don't understand any of it. Damn it. So that's what I'm working on right now. And I think like I thought earlier this morning about whether or not dancing can be used as a method, as part of the trickster methodology that Brian talks about. Mm. And then I don't know if I mentioned this to you before, but in terms of like Native philosophy, Sebastian Purcell and I are going to do a little published back and forth exchange about some of the similarities and differences between North Native American philosophy and Indigenous South American philosophy.
Oh, that's cool.
Given my book. So he like did a review of my book and he was like, yes, 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 not quite, not quite, yes, don't know about that. And then so all valid points, you know. And then so his editor, or the editor of the journal that published that review, reached out to me and asked if I would be interested in doing an exchange with him. And then I asked him if he would be interested in doing one, and he said yes. And so now I've got to start reading a whole bunch of stuff on South American indigenous philosophy.
That's really cool.
Yeah, that's it was, you know, I think it's going to require a little more work than we both think is necessary, but it might be an interesting project, right? So if we're all trying to create a bigger space, this might be just another way of us creating more space for the intersections between Native and Indigenous philosophy, and also creating the space to like differentiate the two, and for different ways for, you know, Latinx philosophers to engage North Native American philosophy, et cetera. So
that sounds awesome. I'm really looking forward to reading that. So, but I.
Well, the books that he recommended to me are all in Spanish, so I had to have my librarian go find me some English versions from Interlibrary Loan. So that's where my starting position is. I'm like, I'm already in a bad situation because I don't read Spanish. But it should be fun. I would think it would be cool if we did like two or three,
right?
Like little small things, nothing that crunched our time too hard, but also made for an interesting dialogue for the people, for the masses, the hungry masses.
Right. That's great.
I know that's people at home are just sitting there going, you know what I'm missing in my life? A dialogue between Shay and Sebastian.
Oh, we can all use that.
We can all use that. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you, Shay, for talking with me about your book. It's a really great book, and I encourage everybody to check it out. So thanks.
All right, no problem.